Case number 12-1416, Lawrence Dodge, Petitioner v. Comptroller of the Currency. Mr. Eric Anderson for the petitioner, Mr. Hendon for the respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Eric Anderson. I'm appearing for Payne & Pierce LLP on behalf of the petitioner, Lawrence Dodge. At the outset, I'd like to try to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal, but we're here today because the enforcement process has simply misfired. Lawrence Dodge promised that ASB's holding company would stand behind the bank, that it would infuse money into it as needed to maintain it at a well-capitalized level. And in the face of a failing economy and mushrooming bank failures, that's exactly what he did. Now, instead of acknowledging that and acknowledging the personal sacrifices that imposed upon him, he finds himself accused of a crime. The misguided result here basically violated the APA in several different ways, and it's built on three central errors. The first are errors of law, second errors of analysis, and the third errors of fact, all of which cascaded together to end in a result that fails to comply with the APA. In particular, there are three areas that we focused on in our briefs, and I'd like to go into a little more depth today. The first of those is the state of mind requirement, which is really one of the central cruxes of where the analysis and the final decision and the recommended decision both went off the rails. As it relates to both the alleged violations, a number of them require that a statement be knowingly false. And in this situation, what we have is Mr. Dodge was part of a group that, in trying to maintain the capital levels, which they had agreed in April of 2007, after disclosing to the OTS several of the transactions that are issued here and receiving no word back that there was a problem in any way, shape, or form, what was clear is that they had agreed as part of the board resolution that what the holding company was going to do was take whatever appropriate steps were necessary to maintain the capital level at well-capitalized at the end of each quarter. And what we've shown throughout the record, and it's unanimous there, but also in addition with the Inspector General report that we've asked for requested judicial notice, is that nobody prior to the issuance of the new directions memo in January of 2009 had any idea that the OTS was going to take the stance that it took about the written requirements with respect to capital infusions and notes at the end of the quarter.
Well, I'm not sure I understand. You're saying that the state of mind requirement, I mean, given our standard of review here, you identify this as an error of law?
And it is, because what the recommended decision and the final decision both did is they took this new directions memo that wasn't issued until January of 2009, mm-hmm. which enunciated a new standard, and they retroactively applied it and said that it was clear and established at the time that these actions took place several months before. And
yeah, just slow down. You weren't actually claiming that these various instruments qualified as capital. And when I say instruments, I'm really being charitable about them, right? We're talking about sort of entries at most. We're not talking about, to talk about them as marketable debt instruments would be fantastic.
Well, what the new directions memo makes clear, and we also argued this in our brief, and also the EITF abstract, is that the actual accounting principle is a little more complicated than the final judgment or the recommended decision gave credit for. Under the EITF, which is the only place that anybody could go to find out what the standards were for injecting capital when it involved a note, the standard is actually fairly lenient, and we've included that in our request for judicial notice. What it asks for in order to count a note as capital is simply that you have a present intent to pay, the capacity to do that, and that you intend to, and do it within a reasonable period of time. What the record establishes, and it's uniform throughout, is that at the time each of these transactions were recorded, the notes that were put forward, the accounts receivable that were reflected in the books, and the plans that were made to reconcile them, all of them intended to have the holding company stand behind the bank.
But the findings go to the fact that, let's assume for the moment that at the time the initial entry was made, there were all these good faith commitments, et cetera, but then circumstances changed and your client failed to ensure that the reports were changed to reflect these changes. And I suppose the assumption under my question is that your client 36 years running this bank, holding company, et cetera, had to know, basically, I thought, what the implication of Judge Williams' question was, that, you know, absent some firm commitment, either in a written form or something else, there was nothing to record as capital.
And I have two responses to that. I'll try to hit both. First, what's important to keep in mind is at the time, there was something in writing. There was a written commitment from the board of directors at the ASC, the holding company, that it was going to do what it took to stand behind the bank. And we know that it was honored.
Doesn't create a high-quality marketable asset.
It doesn't, but it does create a cash equivalent. And one of the things
cash
that...
A cash equivalent?
It does.
What is a cash equivalent here? What is the entity that is a cash equivalent in your argument?
The fact that the holding company has the assets and the money and is standing behind it, willing to bring it forward. One of the things...
What is the thing that is in there as capital that you say is a cash equivalent?
It is the note slash receivable.
For a note to be a cash equivalent, doesn't it have to be a demand note on a solvent entity and in some fashion guarantee?
It does not. Well, first off, there is...
It'd be a cash equivalent. You're not talking about what's an asset.
No, I'm talking about a cash equivalent. And under the EITF, which is the governing standard, what it has to be is a present intention to pay within a reasonable period of time, supported by the ability to do that. And in this particular case, the record is clear. ASC had the ability to do that. It had the assets, and it had the money, it had the money market accounts that were there, as well as unencumbered assets at the parent company level. And in fact, that addresses the first portion of the question, which is, why would he think that? Because there was a combination of the commitment to fund it, the records that put forward that it was going to be there, and we know that he actually did do it.
Ultimately, but what the controller is focusing on is what happened before he was told to reverse these transactions.
Right, and where both the decisions went wrong is instead of looking at what was happening at the time, which is he made the commitments, which, as the IG, the Inspector General, shows in his report, is consistent with what was happening at IndyMac. And one of the things that's striking about the record here is that you have Gary Scott, who was familiar with the IndyMac $18 million backdating that was done at the instruction of OTS. You have a record of Patricia Hildebrand being aware of what was going on and minimizing the fact that OTS was telling people, consistent with positions that it's taken in this circuit for decades, that the commitment that the ASC had made was a binding commitment that they had to stand behind at all times. Now, we will concede that the failure to bring it to reconcile at some point went from GAAP compliant to non-GAAP compliant. But the thing about the decisions is they don't analyze that issue. They never look at it from the right perspective, which is the legal perspective of, you made the commitment, did you have the intent to do it at the time? And what the record does show is that the failure to reconcile is occurring against a backdrop in which this bank is writing down assets at a clip of $8 to $10 million a month at periods of time. That it was, you know, in the face of an economic meltdown, the fact of the matter is the board, including Mr. Dodge and others, were focused on trying to save the bank. And why do we know that? We know that not just because, if you look at it from an ex-ante perspective, not just because they said so later, not just because of the unanimous testimony of everybody that was involved at the time, but also because we know in April of 2008, while this was all still going on, as soon as it became clear just how large these losses were going to be, and the OTS has been clear that it was the market as a whole that caused trouble for this bank, he approached Mr. Scott and said, "We need to inject a lot more capital, much more than $3 million, much more than $2 million. We need to inject tens of millions of dollars." And with the fallout of the sale of the 9800 Mirlands property, which was supposed to have closed by that point, he went and he sought out Mr. Scott, and he asked if he could put that in as an asset.
I mean, I view most of these arguments as you're asking us to reweigh the evidence as distinct from what our standard of review is here. I mean, all these arguments were before the ALJ, and... you know, they were rejected for the reasons the ALJ stated.
But the ALJ went off the rails in two ways. First, by failing to recognize that the standards were not clear at the time. What he did is he substituted in this improper legal standard, retroactively applying the new directions memo.
I guess the point is, I get your point, but the notion that you reflect something as capital where there's no legal entitlement to that capital, I mean, that almost doesn't need a standard.
But there is.
It's so fundamental.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there. No, but there is a legal entitlement. There is the commitment letter by the board. It is a binding requirement that was put in place in response to the concerns expressed by OTS.
So in your view, that was enough to absolve Mr. Dodge of any, I'll put it in terms of liability here?
Well, in terms of compliance with GAAP at the time that it was registered, absolutely. More importantly, in terms of the intent, it's consistent with that intent. What we see in the Inspector General reports is over and over again, OTS takes the position that that's exactly what you're supposed to do. It's only later that they decide, oh, this is really a problem. What we need to do is tighten up those standards, and they do. But at the time, Mr. Dodge, he didn't have anywhere to go. The only place he could have looked is not 110.16, in which OTS has never reconciled how it's possible to reconcile the new directions memo, which talks about notes and says that you can put money in after the close of the quarter, mm-hmm. with the standards in his own handbook. We've submitted, and once, twice, a number of times, that it's because the only way to reconcile 110.16 in the handbook and its definitions and the new directions memo is to say that these notes have to be something. They don't need pre-approval, so they must be cash equivalents. And the fact of the matter is that prior to that date, prior to January 2009, and in February 2009, when they sent it to all of the directors out there, all of the CEOs of these thrifts, it was a different standard. And so the decisions err by applying that standard, and then they compound the error by saying he should have known. The scienter standards here are well beyond negligence. And while we have admitted that Mr. Dodge's failure to reconcile could potentially rise to the level of negligence in the face of all of the other things he was doing to try to save the bank, what it certainly doesn't do is go beyond that. One of the fundamental things that he's charged with is violating 18 U.S.C. 1005, which requires it to be a knowingly false statement. There is no evidence anywhere in the record, and certainly not in the decisions, that says that what he did was knowingly false. At the end of the day, the decisions repeatedly use the words should have known, and at one point even say, he's a CEO and director. It's strict liability. Those aren't the standards under 1818E. They are not the standards under 18 U.S.C. 1005, and they are not under the CFRs as it relates to the requirements of having knowing falsehood. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, you have an analysis that starts from the wrong place and simply says that all the evidence of his intent, and if we look going forward in time, he has 36 years of no problems. They address this. They disclose to the OTS this capital contribution to the GOP and say it's not going to come due for another 3 months. If it's so clear, someone should have said, could have said, that's a problem because you're not doing it right here and right now. But no one did. Donald Kramer did not. Gary Scott, who knew about it, said, I didn't care. They're OTS personnel. The auditors who came in months later said, we think it still might be okay, but we'll get back to you on it. And they couldn't get back to him for months. The only person in the record who is supposed to have known what OTS didn't know, what the auditors didn't know, what the lawyers didn't know, is Mr. Dodge, who doesn't have an accounting training and he doesn't have any lawyer experience. It's an unrealistic standard that he couldn't possibly have met. It's hindsight as opposed to looking at it in context. And what we know is even during the periods of time when this was happening, he was reaching out to Gary Scott to talk about injecting not just the $2 million that were at issue at the very beginning, but $20 million. And he did. The OTS has continually sort of brought up the suggestion that he was caught with his hand in the cookie jar. But he was doing the right thing beforehand. And Gary Scott, who's the OTS regional deputy director, said he acted surprised when he was told about it. He instantly acted to rectify it. And, frankly, that he did everything he could to save the bank. All of which is consistent with his behavior for the first 36 years, and it's certainly consistent with the behavior of the $20 million. And one of the things neither the OTS nor the decision ever confronts is the fact that the amount of money that was put in is far more than could be legally required from him under 1831-0. Far more. It's consistent with the fact that in the face of a failing economy, Mr. Dodge did everything he could to save a bank that had been around for a very long time, which he cared about immensely. And he put that in. Now, the same problems that there are with the state of mind issue and the failure of the legal analysis there and the creation of disagreements that didn't – there's only one disagreement that took place, and that was in December of 2008. Instead, the record shows that there were no disagreements at the time that this took place. And so the decision, by rooting itself on misguided facts like that, by trying to find an effect by using a possibility standard rather than the actual likely standard that governs, is, you know, again, applied the wrong legal standard and then came to the wrong conclusion by failing to analyze the evidence in light of the actual record of this transaction, of these transactions.
All right. So why don't we hear from the controller, and we'll hear.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. My name is Gabriel Hinden, and I represent the Comptroller of the Currency. Your Honors, this is a straightforward case about misrepresentation. It's about the petitioner causing his bank to misrepresent the bank's capital level, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the bank's board for a period of 6 regulatory reporting cycles. By reflecting in the bank's books 3 phantom contributions and non-existent capital. The petitioner did this through a mix of affirmative misrepresentations and failures to disclose information uniquely within his possession so as to make the bank appear well capitalized when it was critically undercapitalized. Based on the record at the hearing, the ALJ recommended and the controller concluded that each of the prongs of the prohibition statute, misconduct, effect, and culpability, was established.
Let's go back. I take it then your theory as to why the various OTS people that opposing counsel referred to as giving a blessing to these transactions only did so because they were not fully informed, and that they were not fully informed because of what information Mr. Dodge withheld.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the theory. So, for example, with the California Republican loan, which opposing counsel mentioned, it is the case that the OTS was notified that the loan would come result in a participation in June of 2007, 3 months after the entry. That is so. But what changed is that when that date arrived, the petitioner extended that note unilaterally over 4 different occasions up to March of 2008, and then unilaterally forgave that note, all while allowing the book to continue to reflect that contribution as capital and allowing the board to believe that the cash, $2 million, was infused in June of 2007.
Does it continue on the books as capital after it's been loan has been forgiven?
Well, the exact dates of the timing, the loan is ordered reversed on July 24th, 2008, during that quarter's examination. The loan remains on the books as capital from effective March 31st, 2007, through the end of the June examination.
But when is the loan forgiven in relationship to the point where it's taken off the books?
I don't know the exact timing, Your Honor, in terms of the date of the forgiveness. The record suggests the loan was forgiven in June of 2008, I think maybe June 23rd. I'm not sure of that, Your Honor.
At least as far as that's the point of focus, we're talking about a few days?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's the continued extensions.
Well, it's a combination.
Go ahead.
It's a combination of the continued extensions and a combination of petitioners allowing the books to reflect the capital, reporting to the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the bank reports that the capital had been contributed and allowing the board to believe that cash had been contributed as of June of 2007.
Okay, but the various extensions were not disclosed?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And there were conversations relating to this loan in which I take it, counsel seems to be alluding to, received some degree of blessing from officials, but officials not informed as to the continual extensions of the loan.
That is correct, Your Honor. The conversations were related to the appropriateness of the participation coming due in June of 2007 and it being backdated to the March 31st. There were no conversations.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
But I gather this backdating is pretty routine, so that's not the problem here, is it? It's that there was a loan out there, and I mean, his argument, as I understand it, is he thought it was going to be repaid. They needed more time to repay it, so he granted these extensions, but he had no reason to believe it wasn't going to be repaid. And at some time, when he learned that, then he forgave it. And you're saying a couple of days passed before it was taken off the books?
Well, with respect to whether he knew the loan was going to be repaid or not, the record shows that that particular promissory note had a requirement that the Republican Party needed to make a request for an extension 3 days prior to the due date of that note.
Well.
And? Go ahead. Yeah.
And in each instance, the Republican Party, in fact, defaulted, meaning asked for that extension only after those 3 days had passed. So in response, Your Honor, to the question of whether the petitioner knew that was going to be paid, in each instance where there was an extension of the note, it was preceded by a default.
As I understand it, though, the record is this was his personal money.
Yes.
All right. He loaned it to his political party.
Yeah.
And I've been around long enough to know in these political party arrangements, sometimes you get paid and sometimes you don't.
Right.
At least from the cases we see in this court, through the Federal Election Commission. And the notion that everybody's not exactly on time is sort of standard procedure, and these procedural defaults are overlooked routinely.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I just want to be sure I understand here why this shows intent. You said this case is all about misrepresentation.
Yes, Your Honor.
To misrepresent that what? The bank had no reasonable expectation that the loan was ever going to be repaid?
Well, with respect to the issue of misrepresentation, it's with respect to each of the different occurrences.
No, I know, but we're talking about the loan right now.
So in this instance, the petitioner had the obligation, upon learning that an extension was required, to notify the OTS and to amend the bank's books to reflect a change when that capital was going to be counted as contributed.
I'm sorry. You seem to be making a jump that your earlier answers didn't. Your earlier answers, I took it to focus on the proposition that the requests for extension raised doubts about whether the loan would be repaid. But now you seem to be going on to an inference that the loan definitely would not be repaid.
Well, if that's what it seems to be, I'm saying that's certainly not my intent.
Okay.
What I'm suggesting is that with each instance where a request for extension was asked, the petitioner had the obligation to notify the OTS and the board and have that record amended in the bank's books so that the OTS was not being notified that capital, because as the OTS understood it, as of June 2007, $2 million was infused into the bank's books.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence of that, the bank appeared under the prompt corrective action regime to be well capitalized.
Right, I understand. But I'm just trying to get a clear picture from you as to what would have happened or should have happened if he had made the disclosures that you say he should have made.
What should have happened after he made the disclosures, Your Honor, is that the bank's books would not reflect contributed capital in the amount of $2 million effective March 31st, 2007.
So you are arguing that the default, the delay in requesting the extension itself zaps out the loan as qualifying for capital.
No, Your Honor, not. It's not the case that the three-day delay itself. I was making that point to try and respond to Judge Rogers' comment related to...
That's my point. If the loan had been repaid...
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's suppose, you know, in, I don't know, August of 08.
Yes.
I mean, would the controller have done anything?
Well, I think that question with respect to... I think you have to think about it in the context of each of the transactions overall, because the overall question...
All right, so unless Judge Williams wants to pursue this, let's go to one...
Well, I do, because
yeah,
I honestly still don't understand precisely what would have and should have followed on the disclosure that you say, reasonably, should have been made.
Mm-hmm. After the disclosure was made, the bank's books, as well as the Thrift financial reports, the reports to the OTS, needed to be amended so as that the bank's books would not be reflecting the contribution of capital in the time.
So you are saying that the fact, standing alone, of a request for delay and the grant of that request automatically invalidates it as capital?
It would invalidate it as capital as it was contributed based on the previous information.
So he could have put new information in the file and it could have stayed on as contributed capital?
He would have had to have spoken with the OTS and had a conversation. And where the point in the line is drawn, I'm not sure where the exact line would be drawn. But the answer is that when the petitioner extended the date of that loan and then forgave it without notifying the OTS.
Let's talk about the extension again. I think that's what my colleagues were asking you about. Mm-hmm. And it seems at times you're saying that it should have been taken off the books at the moment of the extension. Mm-hmm. It seems at other times that you're saying that something should have been done to convey the information that it had been extended. And I'm not sure I understand what the controller's position is on that. I think I'm raising the same question that...
Exactly. And I guess the follow-up question is, which regulation specifies that this must be done?
Well, Your Honor, under 562.2, I believe, of the CFR, which is now, I believe, 162.2, and I'd have to double-check that, Your Honor. But that is the regulation that sets forth the reporting requirements for financial institutions. And included among those reporting requirements would be adherence to GAAP and adherence to any of the guidance issued by the institution with respect to the contributed capital.
All right, but that's part of his argument that
yes.
Where is a specific requirement? And I thought that's what Judge Williams was asking.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, you know, is there some place we can find it right here in the, as an appendix to your brief?
Or the statutory appendix?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Page 15.
Of
the controller's brief in the statutory addendum.
Red brief, page 15, addendum.
Oh, okay. That seems to largely take the form of cross references.
In other words, where does it say anytime you extend a loan, you have to report it, and if you don't, it's
right.
No longer
right, well,
properly reflected on
That's capital.
Right. Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't have that particular citation right now, and I apologize, and I could certainly provide additional supplemental briefing about that matter if necessary.
Frankly, that reference that you give us to the CFR excerpt on page 15 does not clearly tell us what the answer is to the question that we're asking. It may be that, as Judge Williams suggests, the cross-references to GAAP would get us there, but that's a pretty long leap since the reference to GAAP is to GAAP in general and not some particular part of GAAP.
Well, respectfully,
does the ALJ's decision specify the provision that is triggered here?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the
What he talks about is you're supposed to maintain accurate records.
Yes, Your Honor, yes.
All right.
And that is on page 21 and 22 of the brief. Yes, Your Honor.
Of the ALJ's.
The ALJ's recommended decision.
Yeah. And that takes us back to what is a cash equivalent.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could respectfully suggest that.
In other words, I guess what the trouble here that we're having is that I don't think anybody's suggesting the controller is not correct about this.
But yes, Your Honor.
The question is, how does somebody know it?
Well, I guess I would say two things in response to that. First, as a fiduciary of the institution, if the petitioner truly believed that there was lack of clarity as to the regulation, he could have sought specific guidance from the OTS.
Well, in one instance he did, and the OTS person took 3 weeks to get back to him. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's correct.
He didn't know the answer either.
Well, in that instance, the question was whether or not particular property could be contributed capital.
Right.
And yes, it was June 23rd when the request was made, and then July 15th when the response was
But I'm, given. I'm just back to the notion that there are these procedural defaults, but there's no showing that he didn't have a good faith belief that the loan was going to be repaid.
Well, with respect to the faith that the holding company was going to be able to satisfy any of the outstanding capital, the petitioner makes reference to the ability to pay as being one of the standards that needs to be met.
But that's not responsive to my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could repeat the question.
We're talking about this loan at this point, this $2 million.
Yes.
And where is the evidence that he lacked a good faith belief this loan was going to be paid?
Well,
does the controller have that burden?
In this place, the question is whether or not the good faith. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm getting myself.
It's confusing.
Yeah, I'm getting myself a little bit confused. the burden here is on the petitioner at this point to make the determination.
No question about it. But his whole attack is that first the standards weren't clear. He was consulting with Mr. Scott of OTS. All of this was on the books. If there are any questions about it, OTS could have asked. They never said anything. Nobody raised any concerns. So all of that, it seems to me there's some response. It has to be either that if you look at Section 5.6034, you'll see that you can't put loan obligations, et cetera. But that's not in the ALJ's decision.
Right.
He's just talking about you have to have accurate records.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, hypothetically, if Mr. Dodge, in fact, had a good faith belief that this loan was going to be repaid, but the party needed more time, where is there an intent to deceive?
Well, the intent to deceive can be inferred from the totality of the different transactions. In other words, in each of the transactions at issue.
All right, but we're taking them one by one, and you'll get the benefit of the totality. But if one fails, then we're on to two.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So number two.
Well, let's I still want to pursue this question. You say intuitively it sounds completely plausible. There was an obligation on his part to disclose the fact of the postponements.
Yes.
Right. And on top of that, the delay in request for the postponements. Right. Okay. And where exactly is there a regulation, a guidance, anything that tells him that? Besides intuition, intuition can't be disregarded completely, but I would have thought the bank regulators had something stronger.
Well, the standard that I previously pointed to, or the CFR point that I pointed to, sets forth the reporting requirements and incorporates...
Well, it was just a bunch of cross-references.
It incorporates guidance that the OTS...
Where's the guidance? That we're trying to get to the end of the trail.
Right. Well, the guidance ultimately became the new directions bulletin is what ultimately became the guidance.
Mr. Dodge says fairly enough he can't be expected to follow an unissued guidance.
Well, that's true, but... with each of these transactions, the underlying issue is that there was a representation that certain events would occur and that those events changed. And yet,
I'm sorry, a representation that certain... Okay, so what's that representation?
So that the California Republican loan... Oh, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
No, go ahead, answer.
That with respect to the Republican loan, that participation would come due in June of 2007. With respect to the 980 Murillo's property... that sale would take place in the first quarter of 2008, mm-hmm. that with the Mountain View pipeline, a contract would be entered into. But with each of these transactions, the basis upon which the representation that capital would be infused was made turned out to not be the case, in part because of failures to disclose information and in part because of actions the petitioner took. And as a consequence of that, the capital that was purported to have been contributed at certain times, which made the bank appear well-capitalized and forestalled the implementation of prompt corrective action, resulted when the bank's books were finally corrected in order to reflect capital as it truly stood, the bank dropped...
No, I understand that. But I guess the basic proposition, I think, that you're asserting is that when any of these transactions is identified as capital...
Yes, Your Honor.
Certain details about it are included, such as the due date of a loan.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if that changes, it's a significant proposition, and that change must be disclosed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, that proposition, though intuitively sound, was not embodied in a guidance until the new directions.
It would be also embodied in the gap literature.
The gap literature is rather broad.
Yes, Your Honor. That is true.
Can you give us a more specific reference about gap literature?
And not at the present time, Your Honor.
So part of his response is that the holding company had adopted this resolution saying it would hold, stand by the bank and supply capital as needed. And part of the argument is, if any of these things had been pointed out as problems, the infusion would have been made earlier, just as it was when the instruction was to reverse these transactions.
Yes. And respectfully, with respect to that point, The record doesn't support that would actually be something that could happen. When the petitioner was asked at the hearing why, if the holding company had cash on hand, did it not make an infusion, the petitioner conceded that the bank's capital or the bank's liquid assets were otherwise tied up with other business purposes.
At the holding company?
Yes, the holding company.
Right. But the point I thought he was making was that just as occurred later, had he been aware that these were problems, so the holding company could have made some adjustments and infused capital to the bank, cash.
Except that it couldn't. In other words,
because it was tied up,
yes,
but it was never notified that there was any problem. In other words, it was tied up in June of 08, too.
Yes.
And yet it made the adjustments to make the infusion.
And it was never notified of any problems because...
No, at that point it had been told to reverse the transactions.
At the earlier time we were mentioning, that there was no notification of problem because the basis of notifying, of knowing about the problem was uniquely within the petitioner's possession. In other words, the fact that the note, the California Republican Party had been extended was not disclosed not only to the OTS but to the bank's board itself. So as the bank's, the holding company's board, so as the holding company understood it, $2 million had been contributed. That's the same with respect to each.
But let's go back on that a moment. I mean, you say that you have a non-disclosure of extension. On the other hand, you have a loan that's recorded as having a date when it is to be repaid.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that date passes.
Yes.
The quarter after quarter after quarter passes after that. And the loan is still carried on the bank's books.
Yes.
As a loan. Now, it doesn't seem rocket science to say that it's either been extended or defaulted.
Well, it's carried
on. It certainly has not been repaid because then cash would replace the loan as the entry in the books.
That is so, Your Honor. The OTS is notified of the bank's capital status based on the thrift financial reports that are filed with the OTS. Those thrift financial reports reflect the book entries and the capital entries that are placed on the bank's books. In this instance...
So in March 2008,
yes,
says loan, $2 million, due June 2007.
Yes.
And no eyebrow goes up at the OTS?
The examination had taken place in April of 2007. The next examination had not taken place until June of 2008. The bank was reporting itself as well capitalized throughout the duration of the time between the first exam in April of 2007 and the second exam in April of 2008.
No, I mean, the clear point is the obligation is his.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or not his, but the bank's, to file accurate reports.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's just we keep pursuing, how did he know he had to do this? And you're just saying if a loan says it's supposed to come due in June, and you know that money is not coming in June, then you have to amend the record.
As a fiduciary of the institution, mm-hmm, and as the requirement of having to keep your books and records appropriately in accord with the GAAP requirements, yes, Your Honor.
And does the ALJ report ever state specifically the exact form that the amendment should take?
Well, the amendment should take the form of contacting the OTS and actually changing the reamending the
deleting.
Yeah. So, for example, with the reversal of the transactions that took place in August of 2008. That was an example of when the transactions were amended to no longer reflect them as contributed capital. Thank you, Your Honors.
So before you sit down, just want to be clear. Of the four, there are really three transactions, and then this is four.
Yes, Your Honor.
As to the other two, the point was there was nothing in writing
with respect
that gave the bank a legal entitlement to the funds that were anticipated to come if a sale occurred or if some other event occurred?
The sale was expected. There was no writing. And after the sale no longer took place, the capital again remained reflected on the bank's books and records. The same thing with the expected.
But in the first instance, the fact is that there was no obligation in favor of that. There was no writing.
That's right. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And the same thing with the Mountain View Pipeline. No contract was never entered into, and no income actually was derived, and yet that income was reflected on the bank's capital account.
So taking this whole picture, while there may have been money in the holding company, these other transactions were included in the financial reports to the Office of Thrift Supervision.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the problem.
Yes, Your Honor. Because the problem is that the money that was otherwise in the holding company was set aside for other business purposes, meaning not available to meet the capital contributions. As a consequence, the capital wasn't present in the institution. As a consequence, there was no cushion. Capital is a pillar of safety and soundness of the banking institution.
All right, so just go through one bit of the chronology with me. The first expression of concern by Scott arose in April of 07?
In April of 2007, after...
And the investigation started in June of 08.
Well, the April 2007 was the conclusion of the routine examination.
That happens every quarter?
Not every quarter, roughly every year.
And the assumption is that had these reports been accurately filed, OTS would have been alerted to there's a problem as to the capital supporting the bank.
Yes, Your Honor.
And required certain corrective actions.
Right, under the prompt corrective action regime.
Long before June of 2008.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, what counsel just argued about the question of amendment is not the decision of the ALJ, and it isn't the case that was presented below. What the ALJ failed to do was reconcile the new directions memo, which has the requirements in 2009 about a writing on a specific date and all the things with it, against the EITF, which doesn't require any of those things. And in doing that, and what the OTS and the ALJ have never grappled with, is under their theory of the case, the very minute that they registered that first transaction, that GOP loan that was disclosed to the OTS, mm-hmm. even if it was repaid on time, it violates the new directions memo. Their theory is it was illegal at that moment. And that's the problem.
What was illegal at that moment?
That treating the GOP participation, even after fully disclosing it to the OTS and saying that it was going to be paid in June of 2007, even if all those things had happened, it would have been illegal to record it under capital because it failed to comply with the new directions memo.
I don't see the ALJ
saying
that.
Where is the ALJ says that?
Here, at page, the record 522 or page 26 of the ALJ, he says, Dodge admitted that he caused the March 31, 2007 TFR and all subsequent TFRs through the second quarter of 2008 to reflect the claim contribution of the $2 million CRP loan participation and the $400,000 MGF loan purchases capital. So, I mean, he's clearly focusing on this continuing, what I'll describe as misrepresentations in these subsequent reports.
But the thing is, his legal error is he says, and Mr. Dodge never admitted anything to that about the March 2007. That's the one that occurs after, before the disclosures. He discloses that it isn't being paid.
There's no evidence when ALJ says Dodge admitted he caused the March 2007 TFR and all subsequent TFRs to reflect the claim.
Yeah, that's incorrect. Instead, what the ALJ did is said Patricia Hildebrand testified that the new directions memo was clearly established a year or 2 years before it was ever issued, and that was legal error. They analyzed the entire case under this new directions memo that our client had never seen.
But I thought what we were sort of talking about is that if a bank has listed as capital
right.
that it's going to get $2 million paid back by June of 07, and in fact it's not paid back by June of 2007, then the bank has an obligation to amend its next thrift reporting.
Well, and there's two pieces to it. One, and again, I highly recommend the Inspector General report because this situation occurred over and over again. There is no statutory requirement that it be updated. In fact, some of these situations involved the deadline for amending had passed.
But I'm just saying, from a common sense point of view.
Right.
If a bank says it has $2 million in capital based on a loan that's going to be repaid by June, and it isn't repaid by June, you're saying that could just be continued on the books as an accurate report?
Well, it can be under the EITF. The answer is different now under the new directions memo, which is one of the reasons why they issued it.
And but when you say the EITF would permit this, what are you referring to specifically?
It is Exhibit B to our request for judicial notice. And what it says is that there is a, you know, as long as you have the intent to pay and doesn't have any formality requirements, and you have the intent to do so in a reasonable period of time, which is very indefinite, that you can count it as capital. And so, and that gets to this issue, you know, it goes to the issue of the ALJ applied the wrong law. It applied the new directions memo when it shouldn't have done so. It applied the wrong standard of culpability.
I want to make sure I understood your answer to Judge Reagan's question from a moment ago. You're saying that there is no evidence that the judge admitted that he caused March 31, 2017, DFR and all subsequent. You're saying there's no evidence of that?
There is no. What we conceded down below was that under our analysis of what the applicable accounting regulations were, under GAAP and under the EITF, there is a point by failure to reconcile.
That seems to me to be a very different proposition than the question that Judge Rogers asked you and that I repeated to you.
Well, no, because the thing is, if it was proper...
No, yes, it is.
Okay, I apologize.
I'm asking just pretty simple. Are you arguing that there is no evidence to support that statement in the ALJ agreement? That's a yes or no.
You may need
to explain it.
Yes.
But there has to be a yes or no on that.
As it applies to the March 31st, 2007, yes, that's our argument.
Okay.
Later dates is a little more nuanced.
And later dates, there is evidence.
There is evidence.
Is it clear from your brief that you're arguing that there's inadequate evidence for that finding by the ALJ?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we maintain that they've used the wrong standard in analyzing it.
You maintain they've used the wrong standard in analyzing.
Right.
The question of whether there's evidence to support the statement that he said he was responsible for it.
I apologize. I look at that statement as containing two parts. Was he responsible in the sense of participating in the decision to book the capital? Yes.
Okay.
Was that improper?
Okay.
No.
So you're not arguing that there's no evidence to support the ALJ's statement that he admitted that he caused those PFRs to reflect the claim contribution?
Yes, to have the claim contribution at that point, yes. It was a group decision. I apologize if I was unclear on that. But the further assumption that was improper at the time is a different question. And that's where we get to the should have known issue. You know, applying the wrong standard.
I didn't mean to take you beyond your rebuttal, your rebuttal time.
I apologize. I'll make this very, very quick. These same legal errors, as opposed to the likelihood, which is what the statute requires for effect, the issue of the state of mind as it applies to the knowing violations, the issue of personal gain. The requirement here was for ASC to put the money in, which it did. And one of the sections under 1818E says that you can bring this action if the holding company failed to honor its contract. They didn't do that because they couldn't. There was no gain at all to Mr. Dodge in this situation.
Well, as the government argues, that there is an opportunity that Mr. Dodge gets for himself by imposing additional risks on the bank. So,
well,
I don't think that's a winner.
Well, and that's where the evidence comes in. Our respondents, Exhibit 1, shows that the money was always there. I admit this is really a much more difficult situation.
Where?
Yes, Your Honor?
Money was always where?
There was always enough money in the money market accounts to reconcile.
The money market accounts?
At the bank, under Exhibit 1. And, in fact, they ultimately moved $7.5 million from those accounts as part of the $20 million.
Yeah,
right?
And that was controlled by Mr. Dodge.
Well, Mr. Dodge's holding company, yes.
Yeah, but Mr. Dodge controlled the holding company.
Yes.
He owned, what, 85% of the holding company?
Approximately that, yes, Your Honor.
But what would have happened as far as reconciling all this if he died before everything broke?
The money would have still been moved over.
The money would have been there.
It would have been there.
How do we know that the bank would have gotten it?
Well, we know it for two reasons. One,
did he put the bank at risk by this conduct at the very least?
He didn't. And the reason he didn't is because this is a situation where the assets of the holding company are so vast They had so much more money than was necessary under the law.
There was so much under his control, and there was so little of legal obligation for the Monument Foundation and on the pipeline, that it isn't at all clear that the bank would have been made whole if something had happened to him.
And this is where the analysis comes down to. His testimony was that he thought he had the obligation because of the commitment that he had made, which he ultimately honored. And so, the OTS has pushed over and over again that kind of commitment, which says, what's important to keep in mind here is the findings of the ALJ were that it would always have been adequately capitalized. It wouldn't have triggered the PCAs. The reason that they were keeping it well capitalized is because they contracted and committed the board to do so.
Well, but the argument that the ALJ, or not the argument, but the findings that the controller accepted was the notion that, if all this money was there, then why these three other transactions that he knew, was warned about in terms of their being very aggressive and there was some question about them. He had an opportunity, but he didn't do that for whatever reason.
And if the ALJ had been looking at this through the right lens, had been looking at through the should have known and as an ex-ante, what he would have recognized is, as what ultimately happened, is it took a couple of weeks to reconcile. There was some work that needed to be done, and frankly, there was a lot going on. $20, $30 million worth of write-downs that the bank was also dealing with, trying to deal with those things. And so by never giving the right analysis and never asking the right questions, we never get to that. And the one thing I do want to make clear is that, yes, it was, the money was there. This is a situation where there was more than enough assets. And by focusing on the fact that ASC is the one who's the obliging party, not Mr. Dodge personally, there's no gain. And ultimately, he ends up losing tens of millions of dollars more than is ever at issue here.
All right. I think we have your argument. We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.